taking care of our own. And in this series, we've been exploring the different facets of the fact that we're becoming an older society. That I've stated these statistics before, but for those that are new, in 1950, about 8% of our population was over the age of 65. By the year 2050, it'll be over 22%. Mm-hmm. So it's a big shift, and it has some pretty major implications for the way we live and making sure that the needs of everybody in our society are met, especially those needs that come with growing older. And so tonight is kind of a summation of what we've done earlier in the week and hopefully a going forward from that point. I'd like to talk about how we'll need to redefine this idea of responsibility in the changing world that we find ourselves in. I thought we might just start out tonight by making a list of what we perceive some of those needs will be associated with aging and taking care of elderly members in society. So if you want to just kind of toss some of those out, we'll make a checklist before we talk about how we're going to meet the responsibility of satisfying those needs. Anybody want to start us out?
Healthcare
is a big one. Hard to write on this board, so I may not keep pace with you here. Healthcare, custodial, we'll say custodial long-term care. Okay.
Finances?
Having enough money to last?
That's worse.
Try that one.
Yeah. The black one.
Should have taken a cue from the color that was used in the session before.
There we go.
Okay.
Just the ability to stay in your own residence or place as long as possible.
Yeah, I think we can maybe call that preservation of autonomy.
Very good.
And that could mean a lot of things in a lot of different degrees.
Not recreational.
Okay. Recreational.
A feeling of self-worth, especially if it's related to being able to work.
Yeah, since we will run out of room here shortly, we'll say preservation of autonomy, dignity, mm-hmm. self-worth.
And along with, staying in your own home, there would be need for maybe some care, like someone to come in, either for a nurse or for housekeeping or for food.
Yeah, we'll say kind of assisted living. And that would include things like housekeeping. And these things also, I think, relate to this idea of preserving autonomy. People are able to stay fairly independent if they have a little help.
Older people tend to be targets for fraud too. And,
very good protection. I don't know if you were in the village earlier this week when we did elder abuse. If you were there that day and talked about, that abuse is not only physical and psychological, but it includes financial exploitation as well. That's a very good point.
So you're talking fraud, like in presenting more need than they need.
Pardon?
Can you explain fraud and what you're...
Okay, I think it can be taken in a very broad sense or a narrow sense. In a very broad sense, I think it could include any time that someone is asked to rely, on a false promise or a false statement, whether that be that they're being sold repair services that they don't need, medical services that they don't need, whether it's a more
insurance no good.
That's, really has no or minimal coverage. And it could be very specific things like investment scams. So it
the SNL thing.
That's right. The consequences of, poorly managed programs, those kinds of things. So anytime that I think a person is in a position that they're taken advantage of because they rely in good faith on, facts that are asserted and turn out not to be true.
Right.
And financial exploitation is even broader than fraud when you think about situations, and we talked about some of those earlier this week. Guardians who use the person's social security checks for their own benefit instead of for the benefit of the ward, things like that. It would all fall under that. Well, I think we have a pretty good list. And
something that I see, because we live in a retirement community and we're volunteer caregivers to some of the people, is companionship. There's an awful lot of lonely people, especially widows. There are people that beg me to go on trips with them just because they know people.
Sure.
People that I hardly know, but they just, you know, they say it's no fun in doing anything when you don't have something to
right.
do.
Right. Right. There's a lot of loneliness.
This one would be really big needs, bigger than I thought.
A big issue that could be under one of those but is real big is transportation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that also relates to this issue of autonomy, is that, you know, many times people can remain in their own homes if they have some assistance in, you know, getting to the grocery, getting to a doctor, you know, being able to take care of some of those necessities of life when they no longer drive. So that's important too. You know, what strikes me about, I'm really pleased to see some of these things on the board, like companionship, recreational needs. One of the series that I'll be doing next week is on finding spirituality in the active life. And there's a book that's at the bookstore right now that I recommended called The Active Life by Parker Palmer. And one of the statements that he makes is that if we deprive people of the opportunity to work, the opportunity to create, the opportunity to care, that we deprive them of the opportunity of being fully human. I mean, he believes that these things are very essential to, you know, our humanity, our spirituality, and so many times those are the things that are stripped away from people as they age. You know, they retire and maybe they can't find meaning. I don't think work has to be something that's necessarily compensated, but, you know, they don't have something that they feel that they're fulfilling a need out there in the world. They don't have the opportunity to be creative and to do interesting things and to care about people and to be cared for if they're cut off from families and friends, if they outlive family members and friends. I have several friends that are in their 90s, you know, that have, you know, sadly enough, outlived their children. And, you know, and they're best friends in life. And so you're right. This component of companionship is very, very important.
What was the name of the book again?
Oh, the name of the book is called The Active Life. And if you're interested in it, I'll be doing quite a bit from that book next week, but it's on the recommended book table up at the bookstore here holding.
Is it related to older people?
It's not related specifically to older people, no. It's a general book, but I think that concept, you know, applies very well to, you know, the situation of aging and the losses that people suffer as they grow older. Well, what I'd like to do tonight is to talk about some different ways we can think about meeting these needs and whose responsibility it ought to be to meet those needs. And I'm going to draw from some discussions that were had this last year at a conference in San Antonio. It was the conference of the American Association of Law Schools, and several people presented papers at this conference on this idea of what role can the law play and how should we look at responsibility. You people had some good ideas that I'd like to share with you and some of my own and get yours as well, so that hopefully we can start to think about this in some new and creative ways. A gentleman by the name of Lee Teitelbaum from the University of Utah talked about raising the question, what role should the family play? And I think that a lot of us have this nostalgic idea that, well, if things were just like they used to be with the extended family, you know, when we all took care of each other. And, you know, it's his opinion that in a real sense, the extended family probably hasn't existed in that true sense, since probably about the Middle Ages. I mean, we probably all know of some situations of families where the grandparents lived with, you know, my mother's grandparents lived with her as she grew up. But I don't think it was even the general rule, you know, during her growing up years. And so while that is often touted as, you know, the solution to this problem, you know, for better or worse, our society has changed. We've become a mobile society. We don't necessarily live close to our parents or our children or our grandparents. And we have many more single parent families, so that the ability to care for retired people in the home is not as easy as it once was. So we're dealing with some different circumstances. I spoke with, had a very interesting conversation with a gentleman here on the volunteer staff at Holden. His name is Thomas and he's from Namibia. And I talked with him about how do you care for the elderly in your society. And by coincidence, he is the person designated in his family to care for his grandparents. And at the age of 1 and a half, he was basically given to his grandparents to be raised. And really didn't get to know his parents until he was 5 or 6. And this is a fairly common tradition in their culture, that in this way, by giving the child to the grandparents, that child is raised in the way of the grandparents, knows and understands those people. Because as he and I tried to talk about this, I mean, I don't know his native language, and he's, you know, struggling somewhat with English, but in trying to explain to me that there's more to taking care of someone than knowing their physical needs, that you have to know something about the person on the inside, which I thought was a really beautiful philosophy that is just inherent in their culture, that, you know, you really need to know these people. Because he said there's a difference between there being something wrong with the person that's a physical wrong and a sickness that comes from something being wrong on the inside. And so there's this idea that, you know, we, part of this care is not just seeing to the physical needs, it's seeing to those needs on the inside and being respectful of those and nurturing those, so that, you know, a person as they grow older has a peaceful life. And he talked about, you know, this idea of being peaceful and not having aggravation in the life. I also had a discussion with some folks last evening that had spent some time with the Eskimo people in Alaska. And they have a very similar tradition in their culture for taking care of the elderly members of their society. I asked Thomas, well, what if an elderly person doesn't have children or grandchildren? And he said, well, that the families are organized in such a way that there is a head of this sort of extended clan or family, and if there is no one in that sort of a direct relationship, then it falls to the responsibility of the head of that extended clan to see to it that people are cared for. So no one is left, you know, out in the cold. This is Namibia in Africa. Well, contrast to that, that's not, you know, the culture that we live in here. That's not what is developed in our country. And it raises some very difficult questions. You know, we have needs that have to be met some way, somehow. And, you know, one question that I would offer for your consideration is, should it be the legal responsibility of children to care for their parents? And when I say, with the emphasis on legal, you know, should there be a mandated responsibility that children either physically care for or pay for the care of their parents? What do you think?
Many children couldn't afford to.
How could you possibly enforce it?
There are, most people aren't aware of it, but in most states there are statutes that require adult children to care for indigent parents. And they're little known because many of the statutes really don't have any kind of enforcement provisions, and even those that do have enforcement provisions are generally not enforced. And to to the extent that some of those have been tested in some limited areas, I think there's some question about their constitutionality, whether or not if they were really pushed, they'd be enforceable. I think there's something very difficult for our society to justify that we would actually prosecute somebody for not paying for the care of their parents. And so they're not oftentimes enforced. If you look at, but now we do have a legal duty as parents to care for our children. We have a legal support obligation. How do you see that as different? I mean, if we're going to justify one and not the other.
I think we brought those children into the world by choice normally. And so that is a direct responsibility mm-hmm. of ours.
Yeah, and I think under the law, that's where the rights, duties, balance comes into play, that if we of our own choosing bring children into the world, then the law says now you have a duty because of your actions to support this child. But that logic doesn't work in the reverse.
Hasn't the whole social security system given us a false sense of security in thinking, well, they're going to be taken care of? And maybe this whole question now of our balance of payments or the financial problems of our country, we may be moving into a new direction like that again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with the social security system, it's based, as you know, on wage earners paying in percentages every year to fund the program, and while I can't remember what the exact figures were in 1950 as far as how, I think there were something like 8 wage earners, and they count those, they define those as people between the ages of 20 and 64 to every person over the age of 65. By the year 2050, there'll be about 2 people for every 1 retired person. So, you know, the numbers already don't figure as how we're going to support that kind of a program.
Not only that, but your last session said that that amount of money doesn't pay the bill anymore.
That's right. Yeah. For me, it's not keeping up with inflation, and there are all sorts of circumstances that can occur whereby somebody might lose their Social Security benefits or not be entitled to them. I mean, Social Security doesn't apply to everybody. You have to have been a wage earner or been married to a wage earner that would provide eligibility for you. So that doesn't, seem to be a good solution either. And I think looking at these questions of legal duties and legal rights, seems to suggest that if we're going to encourage families to take care of their own, that it really falls more on the moral ethical. There are a lot of good moral ethical arguments about why we should do that, but legally, it's tough to justify, at least in the way in which our legal logic has developed, that kind of support as a matter of law. I think the other problem that we find and would find if we tried to make it a matter of law is that it would cause a lot of resentment. And as we talked about earlier in the week with elder abuse, if someone is not of their own volition doing something, being forced to do it by law really promotes the
something opportunity. Also that. See a problem for instance, our son, who was struggling to raise his own family, and we're retired, and then my husband's father is still living. If he was responsible for 2 generations, it would be impossible.
Right, right. Yeah, they call people in a situation like that in the sandwich generation,
yes.
That if you're still raising up your own children and then having to care for your parents or grandparents, it causes a real squeeze.
I talked the other day about, my half-brother celebrating his 70th anniversary, and he and his wife are doing so well, he's 90 and she's 94. But then in the process of his celebration, I talked with my niece, once removed, but her father is remarried, so there was 3 adults there, and then his parents. So she made the comment that, well, we have 5 people that we have to look after yet. And so I don't know whether it's just different in the Midwest or what, but that's the way people do it there. They feel responsible and they do care.
Mm-hmm. And
one of them has Alzheimer's, beginning of Alzheimer's.
What's making it, I think, a different situation for us now is that people are living much longer than they used to. I mean, when our Social Security system was set up, we patterned it after Germany's system, and the reason that they picked age 65 at that time was because in Germany, people didn't live a long time past 65. So it wasn't meant to be a pension plan that would pay out for 30 years. It was meant to really be kind of a safety net, social safety net, to care for people. And now, in terms of, you know, the length of time that someone either needs to be on some kind of a subsidy program or needs to be cared for, it could be a lot of years. And, you know, 65 is just a purely arbitrary age. You know, we talked, the first session that I did this week was on ageism, you know, and how can you say chronologically that, you know, 65 is equal to being old or aging or having needs? You know, there's no empirical evidence for that fact.
It was when Social Security was instituted.
Right.
It was at an old age.
Because of the lifespan at that time. But now I think that we have a problem in our society with ageism, with, you know, we used to have mandatory retirement. At least we're making some progress there. We've taken the age 70 cap off, except for some, you know, limited circumstances, because, you know, people are not only living longer, but they're living better longer. And it's demeaning for society to say, well, you know, at this chronological age, all of a sudden, you know, you're a senior citizen. Or all of a sudden, you know, maybe you ought to be retiring, whatever. And it's also, it doesn't look like it's going to be real feasible. I mean, even the Social Security system, the age at which you can start drawing benefits is starting in the year 2003. They're going to bump that up 2 months a year so that it becomes age 67 when people can start drawing benefits. So, you know, there is this recognition that there isn't a lot of logic, you know, behind that arbitrary age designation. Well, another person at this conference presented a paper on this whole idea of responsibility. I mean, since it doesn't seem as if we can legally, you know, really build an argument that makes logical sense, then maybe what we need to do is look at responsibility itself and what we're doing here in this culture. Her name was Kate Bartlett from Duke University. She talks about two problems. One, she says, is a size intensity dilemma. That you've got the size of the group to whom you're going to be responsible on the one hand, and you've got the intensity of the responsibility on the other. And what she suggests is that there's this inverse relationship, and that the bigger the group is that you're to be responsible for, the lesser the intensity of the responsibility. You know, and the greater the intensity of the responsibility, the fewer people you can have that responsibility to. You know, and it seems to bear out. I mean, you mentioned these relatives, you're having five people to be responsible for. Well, if they have to take over the total financial care, you know, is it feasible to think that they could do that for five adult people? You know, probably not. And so I think that that's, you know, that's one helpful distinction to look at. The other is she talks about the force freedom dilemma, that the more we have to depend on force to enforce a responsibility, then the less internalized that responsibility is. And the more internalized, the flip of that, that we feel a responsibility or need to take care of somebody else, and the less force it will be required. You know, makes some sense. So she suggests that there's four ways in which we could maybe change the way that we look at responsibility, and I'd like to have your opinions on these. First, she says responsibility shouldn't be viewed as an all or nothing. In other words, you know, we're kind of used to in this country of saying, well, the government ought to pay for that. You know, either the government ought to pay for it or the government shouldn't pay for it. Or that should be something that the private sector takes care of, or not at all. you know, and what she's saying is that, you know, it seems to make some sense that with the kind of needs that are developing, the demographic shifts, maybe it's going to have to be a blended kind of responsibility. It isn't all or nothing. It's going to have to be some overlapping commitments, both on the part of government and on the part of private industry and private individuals. I don't know, what do you think?
I think that's really the solution, because some of these are you can solve with money and people that have saved or people that have some benefits, or they can get something from the government or somewhere. But there's other needs, like taking transportation and companionship, that can be done by the family, or if the family isn't available, if we can get other healthy people who are able to meet those needs as volunteers. I think, you know, if we work together as a society, we should be able to meet those. And sometimes those needs are harder to meet than the ones that just take money.
Mm-hmm. If, you know, let's step back from our present reality, and let's say we have a utopian situation where the government has enough money to meet all those needs, even needs like transportation. Would it be a good idea for the government to do that, do you think? Okay, you're saying why not?
No.
Because?
Well, family involvement. It's too impersonal. Government is impersonal.
Yeah, and that's a fear that a lot of people have, as we talked about the Pepper Commission and some of the proposals that they have for financing long-term care and making some kind of a universal long-term care insurance available. One of the fears that people have about a situation like that is that right now the majority of long-term care is being taken care of privately by individuals, by families. And if we made long-term care financing available on an across-the-board spectrum, that might encourage people who wouldn't otherwise choose that option to go ahead and institutionalize people rather than caring for them at home.
You say long-term care, more than 50% is taken care of private pay?
I'm not saying private pay, I'm saying...
You say by families?
By families, right. Rather than in nursing homes. So a non-institutional alternative.
Okay, but that's not long-term nursing care.
That's long-term care, but not long-term nursing home care.
Because long-term nursing care is mainly taken care of by the government.
By Medicaid.
Because the cost...
That's right.
...is $25,000 to $30,000 a year, which most families can't provide.
Yeah, no, that is true, that even though at any one given time there might be at least half the people paying on a private pay basis, that only lasts for so many months, and then they're on Medicaid and the new crop of people are coming in and on private pay spending their money down, and that's true. But no, the distinction I was making is just long-term care in the home rather than in a nursing home.
What percentage of the population does eventually end up in a nursing home?
Yeah. Well, you know, I wish that I had a figure right on the top of my head for you. They talk about that in so many different ways. You know, it's not as many people end up there on a long-term basis as you might think. I think I've seen some figures that suggest that one in every four persons, you know, over the age of 75, you know, will be in a nursing home, whether it be for convalescence after a hospital stay, whether it be as a permanent long-term care situation. But those figures are real hard to quantify in a way that's meaningful, because people go to nursing homes for such different kinds of stays. Yeah. Okay. The second thing she asked us to think about is, she said, you know, that responsibility shouldn't be limited to a rights exchange model, meaning that if we don't think that there's a right out there to something, that we don't have any responsibility for it. That in this very legalistic society, that we fall into this pattern of thinking of things that way. You know, the only way that I'm responsible is if you have a right. If you don't have a right, I have no responsibility. And instead, you know, she asks that we think about things more in terms of our humanity, and an expression of our commitment to the community, to the collective. Because we don't you know, there may be some of us that will never be faced with caring for a relative who's elderly. Does that mean that we have no responsibility, you know, for thinking about this or assisting in some way to resolve this problem? You know, that's one level of it, and the other is what we talked about before, that if you really can't say that a parent has a legally supported, you know, does that mean that we have no responsibility? And, you know, responsibility is maybe a broader concept in that way. The third one, I think, is particularly important for the times that we live in. She says we shouldn't look at responsibility as a site for blame or credit. And I think what she's getting at there is that if we have an elderly person that's without financial means, there are people that will say, well, that person didn't plan. Why didn't that person save their money? I saved my money. I didn't go on big vacations. Now I can take care of myself. Why should I or the government help somebody out who didn't do that? And as crass or unchristian as that may sound, it's a frequently echoed sentiment in our society. And at a time when we not only have to be concerned about aged members of the society, but homeless members, you know, people that have ended up out on the streets. You know, that anytime we try to put blame, or on the flip side, take credit for how our good planning has kept us from being there. And, you know, it's kind of this idea of losers and misfits. You know, I think to some extent, society likes to identify losers and misfits because it validates what we're not. You know, like the kids did the other night with the Pharisee in example with Vespers. You know, oh, thank goodness that's not me. You know, I planned. I took care of myself. And, you know, maybe what we need to do is find some ways of learning to identify with these groups of people that, you know, we've traditionally thought of as being, you know, somebody else and somebody else's problem. I don't know, has anyone here had experience working with the homeless or maybe your churches?
Well, our church has once a month brings a meal to the senior center and anybody can get a free meal. And there are some working age, able-bodied men that come there and eat. But after going there a couple of times, I realized why they weren't working. They're mentally ill and nobody would hire them. Mm-hmm. There's no way anybody would hire them. They're, you know, just poor contact with reality and have no ability to work.
Yeah.
And they represent about a third of homeless men. I know about women, but I know what men.
It was a real education for me. One of my least favorite jobs after I had my law degree was when I worked with a small firm for a while. And they would send me to bankruptcy court to represent creditors. And being low on the totem pole, I didn't have a lot of choice in this matter, so I would show up to bankruptcy court once a week, and I would have to question debtors who were there about their assets, find out if they wanted to reaffirm their debt to us, meaning the creditor. If they didn't, then I had to ask if they had the goods and when could we come pick them up, or are you going to bring them in, things like this. This is not why I went to law school, but, you know, it was one of those things I had to do along the way. And what really saddened me was that it seemed like I would run into two types of debtors. Ones would be the ones I wouldn't feel so bad about because, you know, they played the credit game to the hilt, and when it went bust, you know, they went in for their bankruptcy. The other folks were people that had, you know, terrible catastrophes happen in their lives. They had cancer. They lost their businesses. They lost their insurance. They couldn't pay their medical bills. Hospital bills are one of the growing reasons why people go bankrupt. And to have to see somebody in that room sit there and be questioned in public, in front of other people, you know, have to explain what assets they had, you know, what happened to money that they did have. It was just, you know, heartbreaking. And in a situation like that, I don't have any problem at all identifying with somebody, because I look at my own self and I think, well, you know, I don't live much beyond paycheck to paycheck. You know, what if something happened to me that all of a sudden I was ill, had to go in for treatments, maybe my insurance wasn't, you know, wouldn't cover it or wouldn't cover it for long. How long could I meet my financial commitments in a circumstance like that? And, you know, I think that it's sometimes too easy to identify these problems in a nameless, faceless way. You know, the homeless, the aged, people who are down and out. So I think Kate Bartlett has a pretty good point there. The last one is the one that I want to spend the most amount of time on tonight. And she suggests that we shouldn't look at responsibility as a fixed obligation, that we need to be more creative in how we look at it, and we need to get away from stereotypes. Now, she's a feminist legal theorist, and so one of the points that she was particularly interested in making here is that, you know, she said that so many women in our society go from the mommy track to the daughter track. They raise the children, and then they take care of the parents. And that the stereotype, one, isn't working, because there are a lot of women that work, and so it's not always feasible for them to do it. Or if they do it, they do it at great economic and opportunity cost in their own life cycle. Well, let's talk about that for a few minutes, and then that's, I guess, where my part of the presentation picks up, because I want to speak to that, and I think go beyond that point. But what do you think about this issue of, you know, we have this problem because this duty falls on women primarily? Have any reaction to that one way or the other?
I'm a classic case of just exactly what you're talking about. We have just now finished raising our family. Our son left home about 6 months ago. And I'm taking care of a mother who is not fully able to take care of herself. I have a job. So, yeah, it can be very, very difficult.
And how do you handle that? Do you have people that assist you with that? Or
I have a brother who is very, very good about it. He spends at least one day a week with my mom. He works 4/10s, and so he has generally 3 days off and is able to spend one day with her. I have a sister who lives out of the area who comes when she can.
Mm-hmm.
But most, I live within 20 or 25 minutes of her, so if there's any emergency or just anything at all, generally it falls on me.
And if there were an emergency, I mean, what do you have to do?
I drop whatever
to
I'm doing.
Leave and work, or?
Well, fortunately, I work for my husband, and so I'm more able to do that than, I'm very grateful for that. I'm more able to do that than somebody with a 9-to-5 job. I can leave the office. But
it poses, and the circumstances that come up are very similar to those of raising small children.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
Child gets sick, you get a call from school, you know, home you go. Any other thoughts on that?
Well, we had an interesting experience in our family, because about 8 years ago, my mother had a stroke, and she also, they thought she was going to die, and she ended up having open heart surgery, but the whole family thought she needed to go into a nursing home. And she had been married for about 6 years, and her husband was in good health, but he just could not take care of her all the time. I had a family, I could not go over there all the time, and I was working part-time. So what we did is that she stayed at our house and lived there, and then about every morning during the week, about 10 o'clock, her husband would come over, and she had to have someone there all the time, needed a lot of care. And he would take care of her during the day, and then I'd be gone, and then when the kids came home, I'd come home and he'd go home. So he got respite, and I got respite by going away to work, and it really worked well, and I've never heard of anyone doing that. But it, for our family, it worked. And then my two sisters were supportive and helped too when they could. So.
Yeah, that's terrific. And one of the things that that presumes, though, is that people are geographically living close enough to one another that they can pitch in and do that. And, you know, my own family situation with my grandmother, there isn't any way that she could have stayed in her home as long as she did, but for a couple that lived next door to her that were wonderful and really kind of adopted her, and because all of us lived out of town. And, you know, that's something that I've moved around a lot in the last 10 years, and as I do, in almost every community that I've lived, I've had the good fortune to be friends with somebody who's retired, you know, more elderly, in their 80s and or so, and I've always felt like what a blessing for me that I've had the opportunity to befriend and support someone the way someone did for my own grandmother. And I really do mean it's a blessing, because I often feel with the friends that I have that what I get from the relationship is a lot more than you know, the time or the errands or whatever that that I provide for them, because of just the wonderful company and companionship. So I think that it's wonderful when families can do that. It's also wonderful when people can be surrogates to each other and take care of that. Well, you know, as a woman, I'm sympathetic to, you know, to the notion that these duties tend to fall on women more than men, and that creates a lot of job stress. But I think as a society, as a culture, that we're not going far enough with it. You know, if we define it like that, what we're saying about the responsibility is that this is kind of dirty work, you know? That it's, you know, instead of asking who should we pay, or should we pay somebody to do this, or who should be, you know, that's presuming that this is not a very valued activity to be engaged in, and somebody has to do it, and it shouldn't fall on women, because why should women, you know, do all the dirty work? That says we've got a real problem, to me anyway, in our society about how we're viewing the natural life processes of getting older and how we live out our life. And so I wonder if it may be in a long-term sense of how we look at responsibility and meeting these needs, if maybe the first step shouldn't be, you know, looking at why we view this sort of caretaking the way that we do. And I think we view raising children the same way. You know, where do you see society praising people because they've raised well-adjusted children? Or because they did a great job making sure that their elderly grandparents had a quality life until they died? Where do we see that reinforced?
I think in our society, just throughout, there's much more value put on taking care of things than taking care of people. I mean, things are really valued above people.
Yeah, you know, we drive down the streets. Oh, isn't that a beautiful lawn? Look at those gardens. Look at that house. They do such a nice job. You know, she always dresses immaculately. Isn't that terrific? He always has the best sports equipment. You know, wouldn't you like to be like that? I mean, it is true. The things that we comment on.
We need to put our grandparents on the front lawn.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see a little rivalry going with it. Take the best care of their grandparents.
Yeah. And I once read of a program, and I've never seen any follow-up on it, where some community organized a program where seniors like myself, for example, could do things like this and earn credits in payment for kind.
Right.
I transport, I check in, I advise, counsel, and so forth, where there's protection. I earn hours of credit that someday get paid back to me when I need that particular service. Now, I've never seen any follow-up on it. It sounds like a neat idea.
I think it's an excellent idea, and there are some communities that are doing that. And I think that, you know, the exciting thing is that I think we have the ability, as members of the community, as church members, to start those programs in our very own backyards. And I mentioned last night that the church that I belonged to when I lived in Illinois, that they donated the use of the fellowship hall Monday through Friday for an adult daycare center. And someone who was here, I don't remember, I don't think she's here tonight, her church was went a step further, and they combined with another church and ran the program themselves. And then, you know, the problem with these programs is how do you pay for them? Because the government funding, if it's there at all right now, is there only in a limited way. Some states take advantage of the Medicaid waiver program where they'll say to the government, instead of us using X dollars for direct long-term care support, we're going to use them in supportive services like adult daycare. But, you know, that is a way that you can get around the expense of it, is by having volunteers provide some of the services and then give those volunteers credit, so if they or a family member ever need the services, that it can work. And, you know,
what
I think...
What other options are there to the nursing home? I mean, within, you're living in an extended family situation, mm-hmm. you have your autonomy, but at some point in your life you're losing, you know, body control and you're needing that yeah. extra nursing type care. Are there other options, or is there just a point that it becomes impossible and that's your only choice?
Well, I think there are options, and it's just a question of how expensive those options are. I mean, if you start at one end of the spectrum and say, okay, we have a model of someone who's living autonomously in their own home, mm-hmm. and then that person needs some help. Well, probably the next least drastic measure is to get some sort of, you know, light housekeeping, meals on wheels, you know, maybe a home visitation nurse that checks meds or checks blood pressure. But when the person starts to need a little more care than that, then it's a question of, well, can you afford to have somebody come live in? You know, can that person go live in the home of another person? You know, up from that stage, I think that we start to look at some of these life care communities where, you know, people can move in and basically live in an independent apartment with maybe a shared dining hall with a nurse available, but not someone that deals with them every day. And usually those communities then have a more intensive nursing facility as a part of the community, and the promise is, I mean, you sign a contract and you know, usually you pay a lump sum going in and then so much a month, and then if you get to the point where you need more care, then you're assured care in the facility. And you know, then there are, you know, all sorts of variations on that theme where, you know, you just pay by the month for an apartment, and then if they have an opening and you need more care, you know, you get into the more intensive
facility. In a family environment with child, mother, grandparent, you know, for that mother or daughter, I should say, to relieve
right.
the stress and the situation there, is that just an assistant or a nurse
well,
coming in?
Then I think you're looking at things like adult daycare centers where, you know, you can take a person for the day while you go off to work, and then you're at home, you know, with your family member at night. Visiting nurses, there are respite care workers that will come out, and you know, for people that don't need to have relief every day because of a job, but they just need to get out and attend to their own life and
right.
the stress and all that. A lot of communities are starting their programs, and a lot of them on a volunteer basis, which is good to see, because the in-home visitation, I mean, I cited $60 a visit as an average, and again, I'm not sure if the person is here tonight, I don't think so, that said, you know, in her home state, it was more like $95 a visit.
That's like an hour care or something? Like
right. That's usually more of a skilled visit. But still, it's expensive, and a lot of these volunteer programs are based on you pay what you can afford to pay. And, you know, I've heard of programs where they pay as little as $2 a visit to maybe like $10 or $15 a visit for those sorts of things. So I think there are all sorts of creative options out there. It's just a matter of whether we're going to be creative enough as caring members in the community to see to it that they work. Because by the time you need the service, you're not in a position to give of your time to really make the program go. You know, then you're on the needing end. And I think that's why it takes, you know, being kind of aware of this and you know, getting a program started that, you know, you don't have a relative that needs it, or, you know, you're not in need of it yourself. Anyone else aware of any kind of unique?
I don't know how many churches have this, but a nurse, a parish nurse, and in some places, like churches of different denominations, will have a nurse that they hire together. And she goes into homes and takes blood pressures and a lot of things that are very expensive if you go to the doctor to do it. And it can be done very easy, better for the patient and much more cost effective.
And the same person that visits gives the security, the person receiving the care.
And this is really a very cost effective way to deliver a certain amount of care. And then also the nurse is trained to do assessments. So she goes in, somebody is feeding while she can assess whether they need to go to the doctor or whether it's just something.
That's nice.
That's true.
You know, I
that should be church-wide. I really do think it's great, especially in congregations with a lot of elderly people.
Because I think we get into a rut sometimes in our church families with, you know, talking about service to the community. We form committees, we get together on committees, we do a lot of talking, drink a lot of coffee, you know, we have our church picnics and things like that, but, you know, how often do we take it beyond that? You know, we provide goodies for a family at Christmas time or whatever, but, you know, these are such isolated kinds of things, and, you know, I think in some ways I'm probably not viewed as a very good church member these days because I don't serve on any committees. And I'm not discouraging anybody from serving on committees, don't get me wrong. But, you know, I spend my time trying to go out and visit people that are shut in, visit people that need to have legal things taken care of and they can't afford to do them, you know, because, you know, we just spend too much time in this country talking about it and not enough time doing it. And it's so good to hear about churches that are, you know, getting out there and really doing it, because it takes a big commitment, you know. And any of you that are involved in those programs know that it's not something you do once and feel good about and walk away. It's something that's, you know, there to be done week after week, month after month. Anybody else have any?
Do you know about any situations where this could be was worked out in a church where the plan would be good? We're in an area where there are four or five new churches started, and our church took on Mother's Day out. You know, I don't know about that, but just to give mothers a few hours a day, 4 hours a day, every Tuesday and Thursday, that they can get out and do their shopping while the kids come to church, and we do it on just making ends meet. The Lutheran church next to us is looking for something to do, but they don't need Mother's Day out because we're taking care of it. They don't need a few other things because of other truths, but that has some real possibilities. But how do you give them an example?
Well, you know, you've just kind of triggered a catalyst in my mind, because I think you're right, and I think probably what needs to happen is we need to have some sample programs set up with, you know, logistical advice, legal advice, you know, the ins and outs of how do you get these things established. And if it were packaged in a way that decreased some of the burden for churches, that many of them would be interested in doing. That's an excellent suggestion.
Like that meets different needs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm a chaplain at a church-related nursing home, skilled nursing facility for 190 residents. Observe this all the time. I'd just like to encourage all of you to be a volunteer at a nursing home near you to learn about the aging process. Not so you get a payback someday, but you get it now in your relationships to these people who are real people with a variety of disabilities, but
and abilities.
And we'll give back to you a lot of the love, wisdom, marvelous stories, and clues on how to live your life as you grow older. So I think we have all kinds of resources and places to volunteer and help and serve if we want to. We don't have to invent a lot of new structures. Your local nursing home we'll say we've got 100 things that we can have you do if you'd like to do.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And you're
step forward and do it.
You're exactly right. And you know, it's
you can read a book to a blind person once a week or once a month. You can play the piano. There's every possible way of providing some human support and kindness.
Yeah, I think that somebody asked me my first day here at Holden why I was interested in this and what got me started down this path, and that was a great question because I had to stop and think. I mean, I'm the oldest in my generation, and so I was very involved with the care of my grandmother and was her best friend. But you know, I thought about it, and I think where it started for me was when I was in the fourth grade, I would go with my grandmother to see my great-grandmother in the nursing home. And I would visit with her, but not only with her, but with the other ladies that would be in the room. And I told this story earlier this week, but I'll never forget the woman that talked to me, and she said, talked to me about her granddaughter, and she said, "Do you mind if I call you Darlene?" She said, "I know you're not my granddaughter, but I haven't seen my granddaughter in so long, and you look like her, and I would just like to visit with you for a while." And you know, it just, you know, that's one of my earliest memories of that kind of thing. But it really struck me, you know, that this woman had a granddaughter, but she didn't see her. And you know, and I thought, well, what a small thing, you know, to sit and visit with somebody for a while. And yet so many children, you know, I hear people that say, "Well, I don't take my children to the nursing home," or "I don't take my children to the hospital because it would be too overwhelming for them. I don't want them to see tubes. I don't want them to see this or that." Well, that just perpetuates, you know, this idea that we take aging and death and we put it in a closet and pretend like it's not there, you know. So I think that's another way in which we can kind of help, is get our kids involved to the extent that we can, kids and grandkids, and being a part of the whole process. Anybody else have anything they'd like to share? And I had one other example that was kind of coincidental. After I attended this conference in January, I never read these magazines on the airplane, but you know, I was really kind of desperate. And I think I packed my briefcase, I checked it or whatever, so I didn't have any work or anything to do on the plane. And you know, lo and behold, there was this great article about the juggling act on family and time management in the 90s. And I'll just read to you just a short paragraph from this that I thought was just a wonderful example. It said, "Many business policymakers now understand that a happy employee is also a productive one. While some large corporations, including IBM, Citicorp, and Xerox, are now helping families in a variety of ways, a small Chicago company is a leader in this area. Felpro Inc., a manufacturer of engine gaskets with 2,000 employees, offers on-site child care, parental leave to care for family members, an elder care service providing daycare for dependent parents. It also offers a summer day camp, summer job, scholarships, and tutoring for employees' children." They said, "By freeing parents from the worries of family pressures, our employees have become more productive. There's less absenteeism, reduced turnover, and improved frame of mind and fewer errors. We find that we are saving money by implementing these policies." So there may be a way that we can go to that production consumption model and, you know, make our goals and objectives meet somewhere in the middle in a way that benefits everybody. So, well, I thank you for coming this evening, and for, you know, those of you that were here earlier in the week and attended the other sessions. It's been a lot of fun.